Thank you, Sam. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice to be with you today. Since we're gathered in Michigan, which gave birth to the American automotive industry, I'll begin discussing the welfare state by talking about cars. After the 1973 Arab oil boycott, gasoline prices quadrupled and stayed high, creating economic and political pressures for cars to get better gas mileage. The trouble is that Americans had gotten used to and fond of big cars that burned lots of gas. The transition to more economical vehicles was difficult for the companies and their customers. During the 1970s, a Detroit auto executive said that the problem his company faced was that American buyers really wanted a car that was bigger on the inside than it was on the outside. The American voter also, it seems, wants a welfare state that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. That is, a welfare state where the value of the benefits dispersed to the people greatly exceeds the burden of the taxes imposed on the people. And of course, whether you're assembling automobiles or a government budget, the desire for an end product that is both big and small is a fantasy. Something's got to give. An important part of the drama of American politics over the past half century has been the question of what is going to give. Are Americans going to acquiesce in higher taxes in order to preserve and expand the benefits offered by the welfare state? Or are they going to accept limitations on and perhaps even reductions in welfare state spending in order to avoid tax increases? Liberals would prefer the first of those two outcomes, and conservatives want the second. Either resolution could happen, but the evidence that conservatives' hopes are more realistic than liberals is noteworthy. The dog that didn't bark of modern American politics is the sound of Democratic politicians urging voters to approve higher taxes. Ever since Walter Mondale made that promise in 1984 and went on to lose 49 states to Ronald Reagan, the Democratic stance on taxation has been that dissembling is the better part of valor. This is striking because the whole point of modern liberalism is to do for America what socialists and social democrats have done for Western Europe: build a generous cradle-to-grave welfare state. Our Democrats cannot fail to realize, however, that the key to the political success of this project in Europe has been the ability of socialist and social democratic politicians to offer and close the sale on a package deal. The welfare state we want to build will have to be extensive and expensive to address our serious social needs, the European leftists say to their voters. It will be so expensive, in fact, that we cannot possibly finance it without taxes that impose real sacrifices on most of our citizens, not just the wealthy. But our promise to you is that a robust, well-funded welfare state will do so much to improve your quality of life that you would be worse off with the alternative: higher take-home pay resulting from big tax cuts and proportionate reductions in social welfare programs. And that's pretty much how the European left governs. In Sweden, for example, one of the world's most comprehensive welfare states, those in the top tenth of the income distribution account for 26.7% of all taxes paid to the government. That amount is virtually identical to their percentage of all market income, 26.6%. In the United States, by contrast, those in the top tenth pay a portion of all taxes, 45%, that is a third larger than the portion, 33%, of the total income they receive. Other famously ample welfare states, such as those in France, Germany, Denmark, throughout Scandinavia, resemble Sweden, having tax systems far less progressive than America's. Why the difference? Because America's party of the left must contend with our distinctive don't tread on me Jeffersonianism to reassure voters more likely than Europe's to be skeptical about ambitious government. America's democratic politicians offer a different package deal. We'll build a welfare state that gives things to you, does things for you, and, best of all, someone other than you, someone richer than you, will pay for it. Thus, Barack Obama promised, as did Hillary Clinton, his 2008 Democratic Party rival, to expand old social programs and launch new ones without raising any federal tax on any family with an income below $250,000, that is, on 97% of the population. By the time he won re-election, Obama had sort of negotiated with himself to a budget deal that held people making less than $400,000 exempt from any income tax increases. That's less than 1% of the population. In other words, having met the easy political challenge, which is persuading voters to accept government largesse, Democrats have voted present when confronted with the hard part, persuading voters to pay for that largesse. Ultimately, however, the hard part determines whether or not the easy part is feasible. Liberal writers, who, unlike liberal politicians, do not have to run for election, will sometimes admit and lament this reality. One of them, Matthew Iglesias, wrote that a platform of no tax increases for the bottom 95% can win elections, but it reinforces rather than debunks the right's fundamental view of the tax question, that public services aren't worth paying for, and merely suggests that the correct answer is to get someone else to pay for them. As a young man, Ronald Reagan voted for Franklin Roosevelt in four presidential elections. He learned many things from watching FDR and applied them during his own presidency. One of the most important was that FDR's insight about political psychology, which was that any agreeable thing that people become accustomed to, they will, in short order, come to feel entitled to, could be used to advance conservatism and not just liberalism. The Reagan tax cuts of 1981 and 1986 habituated Americans to lower taxes, and Democrats since 1984 have pretty much given up on the effort to make people feel unaccustomed to and unentitled to those low tax rates. It remains the case that the welfare state cannot be bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. It cannot, as a permanent, sustainable condition, pay more in benefits than it receives in taxes. The liberal hope is that in the minds of the voters, spending will be the independent variable and taxes the dependent variable. Liberals hope that when push comes to shove, as it will, voters will take the position that tax increases are unpalatable, but benefit cuts are unthinkable. And given that disposition, the voters will reluctantly vote for the tax increases that make it possible to avoid reducing and maybe even permit expanding the welfare state. The conservative hope is just the opposite. When voters accept that they can't have low taxes and generous welfare state benefits, they will reluctantly accept benefit cuts in order to avoid tax increases. In any gathering of conservatives, whether it's in a hotel ballroom, a classroom, or a bar room, I'm usually the most pessimistic guy in attendance. I will close by noting one encouraging asymmetry, however. Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, has offered budget plans that call for bending over the course of the next four decades, the federal spending curve until it comes down far enough to comport with federal revenues, kept at their historical level of 18% to 19% of gross domestic product. Doing so requires big controversial changes, which he has spelled out, such as means testing and voucherizing many government programs. He hasn't prevailed, but Republicans have embraced his approach and kept their House majority while doing so. And there is no Democratic counterpart, no comparably bold, fiscally plausible proposal to bend the revenue curve upward until it comports with promised and desired government spending. Ryan's message to Democrats is, America is having enormous trouble paying for the welfare state we already have, much less the far more ambitious one you guys want to build. If you ever find the courage and then the language to persuade Americans to pay much higher taxes for the sake of perpetuating and perpetually expanding our welfare state, Republicans will challenge these bad policies. We'll acknowledge, however, that they are at least affordable bad policies. It will be easy to know when brave Democrats have succeeded in transforming American politics. That day will arrive when Republican politicians fear that the most serious consequence of opposing a tax increase will be not another denunciation by the New York Times editorial page, but defeats at the ballot box. Until Democrats assemble that electoral majority of Americans insisting on higher taxes, serious governance requires devising spending plans consonant with the federal government's existing revenue stream. Democrats who find the Republican spending plans appalling could do one of three things. One, persuade Americans to accept enormous tax increases. Two, offer an alternative plan, humane and enlightened, for the federal government to address social needs by spending no more than 19% of GDP. Three, convince the nation's voters and the world's lenders that a huge and permanently widening gap between federal revenues and spending is nothing to worry about. There is no fourth option. Until that basic political fact changes, the Swedenization of America will remain a very unlikely prospect. Thank you.